Okay, this is Apologetics 2, lecture number 18. The point I wanted to make about the supposed missing links between apes and men, there's no way to determine how much hair an animal had by from the bones. Okay? So, all these guys got to go on is the bones. Okay? Unless you get like situations like woolly mammoths frozen in ice. So, whenever you see hair on Cro-Magnon man or something, or on Neanderthal man, that's all the imagination of the scientist plus the artist that he's working with, because there's no way to determine it. But so much of this is imagination that sometimes all you have is a tooth, a jawbone, a cheekbone, and from that they assume they could tell, okay, well, that this is a, from a missing link between apes and men, and so then they construct the whole skull and the whole body just based on imagination, and then they find out, like with Colorado Man, he was a member of the horse family. Okay? So keep in mind, science is not as objective as a lot of scientists try to make it. Sometimes they've got their subjective biases that are coming out in their imagination. Java Man turned out to be a large gibbon. Heidelberg Man only consisted of a lower jaw. Piltdown Man turned out to be a clever hoax. I think they took the jaw, either the jaw of a human and the skull of an ape, or the other way around, and wired them together or something weird, or put them together. Peking Man turned out to be a large monkey or a baboon. Southern ape, or Australopithecus, turned out to be an extinct ape, as did Ramapithecus. The East African Man turned out to be an ape. Dryopithecus turned out to be an extinct ape. The Nebraska Man in the monkey trial in 1925, they made a movie with Spencer Tracy in it, and the lawyer holds up a tooth and says, do you know what this tooth is? To the Bible banger who didn't want evolution taught in the public schools. And back in 1925, and the Bible banger said, no, he didn't know what it was. He said, well, this tooth is a tooth. From this tooth, scientists constructed a skull. Now, what he didn't tell them was that they constructed that skull totally from their imagination. They saw a tooth, and they just, their imaginations just ran wild. But he made it sound like they scientifically constructed a skull, and then scientifically constructed a whole skeleton, and from that a whole race of missing links between apes and men. The people in the courtroom were shocked, and it still comes out that way in the movie. They should have made a sequel to the movie, because the movie wasn't made in 1927. The movie was made in the 1940s. Okay? Well, 2 years after the trial, which was in 1925, 2 years later they found more teeth of the Nebraska Man in the same area. But they also found skulls and skeletons, and they found that the tooth belonged to an extinct pig. So, it's nothing but assumptions, biases, imaginations of scientists, rather than good, hard, solid scientific evidence. So the supposed missing links between apes and men, for the most part, have just been nothing but speculation. Archaeopteryx was thought to be a transitionary form between reptiles and birds, because it has teeth and a lizard-like tail and claws like a reptile, yet it has wings and feathers like a bird. Yet it is fully developed, and it is now classified as a bird. It's supposed to be in between reptiles and birds, and it was supposed to live before any birds ever lived. But now they know that they have found fossils of birds that are older than Archaeopteryx, and it's now classified as a bird. There isn't any of the reptilian features that it has that there isn't some other bird that has those, like ostriches have some of these features and all. So it's classified as a bird now, and only outdated science textbooks and biased evolutionists who don't want to get with the times would still claim that is a missing link. Eohippus too, that was supposed to be a missing link between one of the missing links between supposed ancient horses and modern horses. From the three-toed horse to the one-toe, that type of thing. Even that's been shot down to not even be in the horse family itself. because of the lack of evidence in the fossil record, all these problems with evolution, Stephen Jay Gould and some of his... Stephen Jay Gould, I believe he's a paleontologist from Harvard, teaches at Harvard, or at least does research there. But he recognized that there's been 130 years since Darwin at that time, well, even now, 130 years since Darwin, still we found no real missing links, no real transitional forms, okay? So he's proposed punctuated equilibrium, which said there basically there are none. Okay, now I'm going to... The old hopeful monster theory, well, that was the old name for this theory, though Gould would try to say this isn't a resurrection of that theory. But basically, it's almost like saying two apes got together and had a baby boy, and enough baby boys and baby girls were born around the same time so that the human race started. When you look in the fossil record, you'd see nothing in between. Now, I'm exaggerating there. What Gould will say is, no, the transitional forms, there was something between men and apes, and between apes and men, and between reptiles and birds, but these things only lived for 20,000, maybe even 100,000 years. They lived so brief, such a brief amount of time, that we don't see them in the fossil record. So what's he doing? He's admitting that there are no real transitional forms in the fossil record. There are no missing links in the fossil record. So what this guy's actually trying to do, he's trying to explain away, punctuated equilibrium attempts to explain away the lack of evidence for evolution. You say, well, look at those fossil records. No transitional forms, no evidence for evolution. They say, well, we can explain why there isn't evidence for evolution in the fossil record, because the transitional forms didn't last that long, didn't last long enough to be fossilized. But then the question goes, say, well, that's pure speculation, because it's a view that you hold to with no evidence. In the words, even though Anthony Flew and A.J. Ayer would not apply it to that because they like evolution, but to use their words, punctuated equilibrium is neither verifiable nor falsifiable. Okay? Because the evidence, what they're saying is the evidence for it is the lack of evidence for evolution. And so they come up with another version of evolution. The lack of transitional forms is evidence for creation, period. The reason why the species appear suddenly and fully developed in the fossil record is because that's the way they were created. Fully developed. Separate species. Not one evolving into another. The question also comes up, has evolution been abandoned? Evolution means gradual change. Punctuated equilibrium means this gradual change within a species, and all of a sudden, boom, just a big transition into another species so fast that the fossil record can't even keep track of it. And then it goes back to gradual change, and then boom. So it's kind of like these little, like on a heart monitor, these little tiny peaks, and all of a sudden, boom, one gigantic peak, and then these little tiny peaks again. That's not evolution. That's not gradual change anymore. That's a whole new ballpark. Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy. This, by the way, Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy is going to hurt the standard atheistic evolutionary view as much as it's the abuse of it is going to hurt creationism. Okay, it cuts both ways. What it's going to do with modern science is take modern science. See, you can't do science. Man can't even think without making religious assumptions. Just to do science, you assume the existence of the real world. You have to make certain assumptions, and you can't do your science in a vacuum. You either do your science assuming the truth of Christianity, or assuming the truth of atheism, or assuming the truth of some religion. Well, what Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy is actually going to do is the abuse of this principle is going to take science out of the religion of atheism and into the religion of pantheism and the New Age movement. In other words, quote-unquote, scientists of the future are going to be predominantly a bunch of New Agers that are saying things happen without a cause, that the universe is one being. Yeah.
I see. My interpretation is, as you heard in the question, the more you know about the position or the velocity of a subatomic particle, the less you know about the position of the velocity. And all that really does is prove the inaccuracy of our method of interpretation.
Yeah, exactly. And then Einstein, you're in good company. Max Planck, one of the world's leading physicists, and Einstein, Albert Einstein, held the same view. Basically, Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy is a theory in quantum physics on the subatomic level that the subatomic particle movement is presently unpredictable for man. We can know either the location or the velocity, but if we know one, we can't know the other. Something along those lines?
That's Jeff's closer.
Okay, wait, what was he?
It's basically that there's a certain margin of error, and you can, let's say my hands represent where the particle is and how fast it's moving.
Mm-hmm.
The closer you get to one, the further you get from the other.
And so the
you can reach like a happy medium, and depending on the size, too, like for instance, an object the size of this pen,
mm-hmm.
the indeterminacy principle is smaller than measurable. I mean, I can tell you exactly where this pen is, and it's moving around now.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you exactly where it is and exactly how fast it's moving.
Mm-hmm.
It's so big that the margin of error is too tiny. But when you get down to the subatomic particles, the margin of error becomes bigger than the particle itself.
There's even some that believe that just in observing the particles might have some type of effect on them as well.
Yeah, that's a different principle, right?
Yeah. Okay.
You like from microscope.
Sort of, yeah.
But it actually would have an overlap with this because they're still talking in the same context that they think that could further dampen their chances of making accurate measurements.
This principle had only came about when you're just talking about particle physics and quantum physics, because until you got to particles that small, it wasn't having an effect.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to particles that size, the more accurately you know the speed, mm-hmm. the bigger of an area that the particle might be somewhere mm-hmm. in this sphere, we're not sure exactly where.
What a lot of guys are arguing for this is that they're saying that things are happening without causes on the subatomic level, which is not what it's about at all. Because we cannot determine why something is occurring or how something is occurring, we can't measure something, doesn't mean that it's occurring without a cause or that it cannot be determined. It just means that we're not yet able to accurately predict where a specific particle will be at a given time within this field. So Max Planck holds this position. Einstein, as I mentioned earlier, that if you want to think of it in terms of a cause, which even that I think is misleading, but this is the way it's being used right now. The Tao of Physics was a book that's leaning very heavily in this direction. But if you want to refer to it as, give an analogy of it, it's not so much that things are really happening without a cause, is that sometimes things are occurring on a subatomic level that we can't explain the cause, or we don't know what the cause is as of yet. Okay, so it's proving is we are not omniscient. It is not proving something new about reality, that things pop into existence without a cause. But you do have, there were some evolutionists who, when you get them in a corner in a debate, they would say, well, Heisenberg's principle proves that things can happen without a cause, so maybe the universe popped into existence without a cause. Number one, if you want to be an evolutionist and hold to that, good luck, because all science would crumble. If things can occur without a cause, all science crumbles. Because we assume that things make sense, there's reasons why things happen. When we're looking at something, we're looking at the effect of some cause, and that there's a relationship between the elements of the universe. If things can occur without a cause, then if you find a body laying down with a knife in its back and blood all over, yeah, that could have happened uncaused. So why even do the crime scene investigation to try to determine who murdered them? Maybe nobody did. Maybe it happened uncaused. So Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy, the one thing we should learn from it is that man is not omniscient. Man doesn't know everything. There are some things about this universe we haven't fully figured out. I mean, here you got scientists saying dinosaurs don't exist, and you have thousands upon thousands of eyewitnesses, people from all walks of life and all different languages, different countries and stuff, saying that they've seen some type of dinosaur that scientists say are extinct. And eyewitness testimony holds much more weight than circumstantial evidence, and most of evolutionary science is based on circumstantial evidence, and it's open to a variety of interpretations other than evolution. I think we need to recognize we are not infallible, and there are some things we don't know, and Heisenberg's principle should humble us and show us we're never going to fully figure this universe out because of the infinite God who created it. And there are complexities in this universe we won't be able to fully figure out, but it does not mean that things happen without a cause. So maybe the universe popped into existence without a cause. There are many unproven assumptions with evolution. For instance, there is no evidence for spontaneous generation. They assume spontaneous generation occurred. There's no evidence for it. It violates the cell theory. The cell is the smallest unit of life, and all cells came into existence through prior, were produced by prior existing cells. It's an assumption that the first living cell had to have evolved from non-living material. That's an assumption that's never been proven. No evidence for spontaneous generation. Louis Pasteur shot that down. And there's the law of biogenesis, only living things give rise to other living things. The Miller and Urey experiments, we talked about them, the attempts to bring life from non-life in a lab. If successful, it would only prove that intelligent intervention is needed, so it would favor the creation model, not the evolution model. Geisler argued that the production of amino acids is as far from producing life as a single sentence is from one volume of encyclopedia. One volume encyclopedia, that's the DNA. That's about the amount of the complex information found in the DNA of a single cell. Now, if you take the DNA plus the RNA and all the genetic material in the cell, then you come up with enough information to fill an entire library, okay? And so what guys are saying, amino acids are only like a single sentence. But then even Dr. Wickramasinghe, one of Great Britain's two eminent scientists, him and Hoyles, he calls these experiments cheating. Because he says these guys start with amino acids, you know, the building blocks of life, they break them down, and then they recover amino acids. So how can they say, well, see, we prove life comes from non-life. They're getting what they start with. Anyway, another unproven assumption of evolution is either that the universe is eternal, which there's no evidence for that. All the evidence, scientific evidence, goes against that. Or that then, since it's not eternal, the universe could not evolve from nothing. There are scientists who are trying to say the universe could have evolved into existence from nothing. Usually they do a proton electron or a proton neutron type
proton
thing.
Antiproton.
Yeah, you got something that's a positive one and something that's a negative one. You add them together and it's zero. Yeah, but it's still not nothing. Nothing. You don't have a positive something, a negative. You have nothing. Nothing is nothing. Nothing does nothing. Nothing can cause nothing. Nothing can evolve into nothing. Nothing is nothing, period. That's another unproven assumption. There's no proof for intelligence coming from non-intelligence, multi-celled animals coming from single-celled animals. Even the human embryo doesn't evolve into a human. The full genetic code, human genetic code, is in place at conception. There's no proof for animals with backbones coming from animals without backbones, and no evidence for the common ancestry of fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals. Common anatomy could point to common design more easily than common ancestry. What I'm basically saying, that when you add all these assumptions that are made, assumption is something that is assumed, presupposed, it is not something that is proved. Okay? So basically what I'm saying is, every gap that evolution needs to cross, every gap that must be bridged for evolution to be proven is an assumption. And so if all the necessary gaps that need to be bridged to give you evolution, if every one of those gaps, every one of those bridges over the gaps is an assumption, then what does that tell you about the ultimate scientific status of evolution? It tells you that evolution itself is one big, fat, ugly, unproven assumption. That's all there is to it. Life from non-life, multi-cell from single cell, you know, right on down the line, it's just nothing but a complete assumption. Closing our lectures on evolution, evolution needs God, but God does not need evolution. If evolution is true, God is still needed to bring the universe into existence from nothing, to bring life from non-life, and complex life forms from simple life forms. For in each case, a miraculous superseding of natural laws is needed. But if God exists, he doesn't need evolution. He could have merely started the long evolutionary process, or he could have created the universe in 6 literal days if he chose to. So God could have used evolution, but if he did, he left absolutely no evidence. He would have covered his tracks, but then I think we could turn around and say, you know, would this not make God the author of deception? Once Galileo was scoffed at by fellow scientists for believing that the Earth revolved around the Sun. What? For believing?
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought I was saying something. Once Galileo was scoffed at by fellow scientists for believing... This was supposed to be dramatic, too. Once Galileo was scoffed at by fellow scientists for believing the Earth revolved around the Sun. Now creationists are being ridiculed for saying, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. As the decades pass, creation science will be vindicated just as Galileo was vindicated by future study. Unfortunately, many evolutionists may never be able to abandon the blind faith they hold in the dead and unscientific religion called evolution.
I don't know, it's a valid point, but I think that it would be wise to not use Galileo if you're arguing with a non-Christian, an atheist, because the Galileo's argument was not with fellow scientists as much as it was with the church.
It's not even opening a can of worms, because believe me, when I debated the issue and when I also went head to head with Mr. Turner at Central Kitsap High School, that he brings that point up right from the outset.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I point out to him was the church was the state. So if you want to slam the church there, you got to slam the state as well. Number two, the second point I point out, I am a Protestant. So I don't need an atheist to tell me that Roman Catholicism was messed up. I was brought up in Roman Catholicism, and I made a bigger statement against Roman Catholicism than any atheist has ever done. So I don't need other people to tell me what, I don't need Bertrand Russell to define for me what a true Christian is. And so I see no problem with that at all. The problem was not the Church of Jesus Christ. The problem was a pseudo-church that had given a fallibility to the teaching magisterium. The fallibility of the Pope didn't come later, but a lot of people, the Catholic Church for years proclaimed infallibility to the whole council, the College of Bishops. In 1870, the infallibility of the Pope was the question of whether that infallibility ultimately rested with one man, the Pope, rather than the whole college. So I really don't even see that as a major problem. In fact, I usually turn it on him. I say, even if we call what you call the church, let's give you that premise, and let's admit that the church spoke infallibly. They had an infallible, even though there wasn't the infallible Pope at that time, we'll just call it the infallible church at that time, shut down scientific investigation. Well, we have that same problem today. The same problem that Galileo had with an infallible church that shut down his scientific thought and kept science in a box and wouldn't allow it to advance, we have that same problem today, but it's not an infallible church. The problem today is a bunch of infallible scientists. The average person, even when you debate, the average person when you debate them on creation versus evolution, they will not give you evidence for evolution. Every once in a while you'll get a guy who tries to do it. But they all they do is give you a list of infallible evolutionary scientists. And what they're saying, the majority of scientists, whatever is the most popular theory or the most popular model, they have spoken ex cathedra. They have spoken infallibly. So I don't even see it really. If they want to bring that up and think they're hitting a sore spot with me, that's fine, because I've usually milked that for all it's worth. And by the time I get done cleaning house on that particular point, because you know that when you look at that situation that Galileo was under, that persecution that he was under, that is exactly the case for people like Dr. Henry Morris and Dwayne Gish today. They are being they are losing teaching positions. I mean, 1925. The ACLU was arguing in that case, it is unfair to teach only creation in the public schools. You need to teach both creation and evolution. There are two different views about the origins, the origin of the universe, origin of first life, origin of new life forms. In the 1980s, the ACLU, in the second monkey trial, argued it is wrong, it is unconstitutional to teach both creation and evolution. Only evolution should be taught. So if they want to butt heads and see who's inconsistent, I have no problem with that whatsoever. And I'm glad Martin Luther came on the scene. And my life exemplifies that much more than any atheist who had a sore spot for all religion except atheism all his life. That's no problem at all.
Wasn't Copernicus involved in that too?
He came later. He was the one who finally got it hammered through and got a few people's heads that yes, this is true and accepted.
Yeah, see,
Galileo was basically ordered not to teach it anymore. He was forced to recant publicly. You know, I'm sorry, I was wrong. The sun goes around the earth. The earth stands still, and the sun goes around it. However, as he stepped down from the podium, legend has it that he said under his breath, you know, so a few people around him heard, and yet it moves, meaning the earth. Mm-hmm. And then it was like 60 or so, maybe it was more than that. But it was later that Copernicus finally was able to prove that the sun was a stationary body.
But didn't some of the Islamic philosophers do that long before?
I think so.
Actually, it was Greeks.
We had algebra while you were still...
Actually, the Greeks... There were Greeks like about, I don't know, it was 300 years before Christ had figured it out. In fact, Gordon Clark in his History of Philosophy gives a test. He says if you do this, there's an easy way to figure out that the earth goes around the sun, not the other way around. And then he gives you enough hints to where if you're a genius, from the hints he gives you, you can run your own test and it'll prove the earth goes around the sun. But the problem is, I'm not a genius. I didn't figure out what the heck he was talking about.
You just need sticks and a shadow in the line of sight.
And he basically told you what you need, and he told you, he kind of hinted the direction you got to move. And I was totally lost. I didn't know what the heck he was talking about. So, but I hated science. I never did. I used to go right by the book, do these things, and this will be the result of your experiment in science lab class. And get everybody else, go, oh, yeah, did it and everything. And I'm looking at, you know, my thing is supposed to turn green and it's like black, just, you know. Maybe we'll just get started on AP 15. We were actually supposed to finish evolution before we even started this lecture, but now we need to talk about the philosophical evidence for God's existence. We touched on a lot of this stuff already. The five main types of arguments for God's existence are the cosmological, teleological, moral, the ontological argument, and the argument from religious experience. The cosmological argument is an argument from the effect to the cause. It argues that the universe needs a cause, or some element in the universe needs a cause, and you argue to the first cause of all else that exists. King David, Psalm 19:1, said, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands." Romans 1:18-22, Paul tells us that we haven't seen the invisible God, but we've seen the visible work of his hands in the creation. And the visible creation proves to us the existence of the invisible God. Hebrews 3:4, an interesting passage, tells us that every builder has a house, but the builder of all things is God. But it's a basic cosmological type argument. We'll look at some of those. The teleological argument argues that the universe is a product of intelligent design, therefore there must be an intelligent designer. You can get that from even from Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, the sky proclaims the work of his hands, the beauty of the universe, the complexity, the order, the design. Psalm 94, verse 9, he who planted the ear, does he not hear? He who formed the eye, can he not see? The design in man tells us that the designer must have some of these attributes. And then once you use that same reasoning and you go to the intelligence found in human beings for the lack thereof, you can conclude that God is an intelligent designer. The moral argument, Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Paul argues that even when Gentiles who don't have God's laws written on tablets of stone, when they show by their actions that they consider the same things wrong and the same things right as the Jews, that proves that God's laws were written on their hearts and their conscience. And so from man's knowledge of moral values, that certain things are right and certain things are wrong, and the moral laws are above all men, that tells us that there must be a moral lawgiver above all men. Now, even the atheist and the pantheist who often denies the existence of an absolute moral law, universal moral laws objectively existing above all men, in actuality, they live like there is a moral law above all men. I mean, like, let's say that there is no moral law. There is no such thing as right and wrong. I can go into the lab and prove anything that I want because I don't have to go by anybody's rules. I mean, isn't it assumed that to do any kind of scientific experimentation that it is unethical to cheat in your experiments and to bring out, to claim that there's results from your experiments that aren't really there? And so even to do science, we have to assume certain moral values. The argument from religious experience, the first three, cosmological, teleological, and moral, we're going to look at examples from those. However, we are not going to look at the next two. I'm just going to touch on them briefly here because I don't think they're as powerful as the other three. And by the way, I think the most powerful argument is the cosmological argument, and then I use the teleological and moral arguments as the finishing touches to show that the uncaused cause of the universe, as proven by the cosmological argument, is a personal uncaused cause, a personal being, because he has intelligence and he is a moral being. But the argument from religious experience is the argument that all men sense a need for God, and every other need that man has somewhere exists something that could meet that need, even if the man never gets it. For instance, a guy who's starving to death or dying of thirst, water exists and food exists. Now, he might not be able to get to it, he might not find it, but it's still there. Well, the argument for religious experience argues, Geisler and Cordouan in their philosophy of religion present this really well. This argument argues that all men, even atheists, when you look at their writings, I mean, even Walter Kaufman called man, he's an atheist, and he called man the God-intoxicated ape. He admits that man, the thing that separates men from apes, is that man is intoxicated with this idea of God, whereas the apes aren't. And so all men sense a need for God. Now, Sigmund Freud tries to explain it away as wish fulfillment and Feuerbach as, you know, man just creating God by his imagination. But the fact of the matter is, those guys are trying to explain why 90 to 95% of the world disagrees with them. So maybe it's not wishful thinking. Maybe it is a genuine need. And if you can prove that premise, that man does sense a real need for God, then you've got a pretty strong argument for God's existence. And the way Geisler and Cordouan do it, they go through the writings of Sartre, Kaufman, Freud, Feuerbach. They go through the writings of the atheists, the guys that would be least likely to admit that they have a need for God, and they show that in their writings, in some type of Freudian slips, if you will, they actually admit that they have a strong desire or a strong need for God. And And since everything else that man needs does exist whether you find it or not, it would seem to imply that God exists whether you find him or not. Matthew 4:4 would be the biblical justification of that type of argument. Jesus said, man does not live on bread alone, but on every utterance of the mouth of God. What he's saying is man is more than just a physical being. Man has more than just physical needs, but he even has spiritual needs as well, a spiritual thirst for God. Jesus Christ said he's the bread of heaven, John 6:35. Everyone who comes to him will not hunger, and he who believes in him shall never thirst. So Jesus was claiming to quench the thirst for God that all men have. The way Augustine said it was, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. The way Blaise Pascal referred to it was, he said that in the heart of man is a God-shaped vacuum that only God can fill. But all men sense a need for God, and what we need exists in every other case, so we shouldn't assume that God doesn't exist, and that this is the only case that man needs something that isn't there. You don't need non-existent things. You don't need a fairy godmother. You don't need, that's what it gets me about atheists. If they really believe God is non-existent, why do they hate him so much? You don't find huge organizations trying to take over the universities to disprove the existence of Santa Claus because there's a few people on earth that believe Santa Claus exists, okay? Then there's the ontological argument. It argues from the idea of God, the concept of God is a being who cannot not exist. And since it's a contradiction to say that a being, a necessary being, a being that cannot not exist, does not exist, therefore a being that cannot not exist must exist. Therefore God must exist. And that has been thrown back and forth. You've got great thinkers today who think it's valid, and great thinkers today who think it's not valid. And then the same could be said throughout the history of philosophy. And I just don't want to touch that one. It's a hot potato. But the cosmological argument we'll be looking at. But what I want to do right now is look at, on page AP16, we'll look at first the teleological argument from William Paley, and then the moral argument from C.S. Lewis. And next week we'll start looking at the cosmological argument. The teleological argument from William Paley, he's famous for it, 1743 to 1805. Actually, the fifth way? Aquinas is five ways. You remember, John? Okay. Aquinas, one of Aquinas' arguments was a teleological argument. He argued that things in nature, mindless things in nature, work towards a goal. And we know that things only work towards a goal if there's an intelligent mind behind them, working them towards that goal. So mindless things in nature must be moving towards a goal under the governance or the providence of an intelligent being. Well, William Paley, he's famous for the modern type of teleological argument. He lived from 1743, died in 1805. He argued that if you found the watch in the wilderness, even if you never saw a watch before, because of its design and its complexity, you would recognize that it needed an intelligent watchmaker. Then he argued that the universe is one of design. You move the sun a little bit closer to the earth, we'd all fry. You move the sun a little bit further from the earth, we'd all freeze to death. Everything, see, there's enough oxygen for man to breathe. Life on earth shows that the universe was designed. It didn't happen by chance. It was designed to sustain life. A single-celled animal has enough genetic information to fill one volume of an encyclopedia just in the DNA. When you add the RNA and other genetic factors, you've got enough information to fill an entire library. So if a single cell is that complex, what about the entire universe? It seems that the universe is one of design, and therefore the universe is the product of an intelligent designer. No matter how many explosions you have in a print shop, you will never accidentally produce a Webster's Dictionary. It takes intelligent intervention, intelligent design, to produce a Webster's Dictionary. Yeah.
Who was William Perry trying to refute at that time?
People will argue that before Paley wrote, David Hume kind of preempted the thought of Paley and refuted it in his writings, Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, excellent book to read. In actuality, Paley seems to have had been knowledgeable of Hume's work because he responds to all the objections of Hume. Okay? Also, there's a big... Hume was famous for making statements that they don't like to talk about now. He lived his life in two different stories. He had his philosophy, only recognizing that you couldn't know hardly anything at all with certainty, but then he had to live a life as a real human being, and he understood the contradiction between the two. So at the end of his work, he even admits that he finds, though it has problems, the teleological argument still being more probable than the alternatives to it. But what Hume showed, by the way, was that since, you know, the universe is designed, but a watch is designed, but a ship is built, is designed, but it has many designers, maybe the universe has many gods who designed it. Then he said, hey, we find evil in the world. Maybe the designer or designers of the world is or are evil. Then he said, the universe is finite, it's not infinite, so maybe its cause is only finite. Okay? Now, I think there are ways to argue against those so that you get, like, you know, 51... I think you could prove that it's probably, like, 51%, it's probably one God because there's so much unity in the universe, rather than many, but still, there's, you know, it's a 51-49%. It's a pretty close thing, but I think the benefit of the doubt should go to the theist. But I think we can avoid all of that by starting with the cosmological argument. Then you rule out a finite cause of the universe. You rule out an evil God, because you can't have an infinite evil. You rule out many gods, you can only have one infinite being, and then when you get to the teleological, all you're doing is adding intelligence, and now you got a personal uncaused cause, infinite God. So I like using the teleological argument all alone. I like using it like Geisler, teleological and moral, as the finishing touches to a good, solid cosmological argument. The moral argument, one of the guys that was actually one of the... although you could see heading in that direction, even the writings of Plato. But Immanuel Kant argued that through pure reason you could not prove the existence of God, but through practical reason you should posit the existence of God and the afterlife. Because... to make sense out of man's moral life. In other words, he said, through pure reason alone, you can't prove God's existence, and I don't even know if God exists, but I think we ought to assume that God exists, and that there is life after death, and there is punishment and reward. And so we need to assume that, otherwise, you know, we're going to be killing each other off. But C.S. Lewis also used a moral argument. He lived from 1898 to 1963. He argued that all admit to an objective moral standard, at least when we're wrong. We might not admit it in philosophy class, but we admit it when we go home and our brother or sister steals our crayons from us, okay? We all admit to an objective moral standard when we're wrong. Nature is non-moral. Now, you might want to argue with Lewis on that point, but I think he's got the benefit of the doubt. I think it's pretty tough to prove that a rock or a mound of dirt is moral. Okay? Nature is non-moral. Therefore, the objective moral standard must come from a supernatural cause. By the way, Lewis also used the same argument with reason. All must admit that there is intelligence. If you try to say, no, there isn't intelligence, you're using intelligence to deny intelligence, okay? You're uttering an intelligent statement to say that there's no intelligence, which questions whether that statement was very intelligent. But nature is non-intelligent, therefore the objective moral standard, therefore the objective existence of reason, of intelligence, must come from a supernatural cause. Yeah?
So Immanuel Kant had a sort of a dialectic where he said on the lower star we have a moral life, but we can't make sense of it unless we have an ethic for it.
Yeah, well, his distinction between pure reason was just pure thought alone, but practical reason was, hey, we got to live our everyday lives. Let's just assume. I don't even know. Kant was, if I read him right, was saying, hey, I don't even know if he does exist. But let's just assume that he does. There's a lot of guys will use Kant to disprove Christianity, and they forget that he used a pretty strong argument for the existence of God, at least. So they try to use him to disprove the existence of God. He actually had an argument for God's existence. That's all I want to cover right now. We'll pick up with the cosmological argument next week.
We're shooting Friday?